Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, April 21, 2022. Good afternoon, Dave.
Oh, is it Thursday already?
It is. That's why you're here.
Hey, indeed. Happy National High Five Day.
Can you
believe that? Put your hands up high.
Haven't you run out of those yet?
Hey, no. I'm just getting started, I'm afraid.
Oh, no.
Hey, more importantly, though, it's National Get to Know Your Customers Day.
Melody,
you know best how we already know all of our customers well.
We do.
And all newcomers who are listening, you'll get the same kind of personalized attention that those we've been doing business with for over 25 years have gotten. So for all your gold and silver needs, call us toll free at 1-800-375-4188.
Thank you, Dave.
Hey. That's what I'm here for.
Okay. Well, gold today, I'll tell you what I'm here for. Gold today was down 560 at 1,953. They came and crashed it in the morning, but it did claw back. So we're looking good at 1,953. Silver was down 50 cents today at 2,477. Platinum was down 20 at 977. And palladium was down 37, 2,482. The USDX today moving into that 101. It's getting close. 100.63 up 0.29. Crude oil was up 154 at 103.73. Paper markets today, they took a little bit of a hit in the afternoon. Pretty big, sharp reversal. They were all positive, up a couple hundred, I thought, this morning. Dow was down 368 at 34,792. S&P down 65 at 4,393. With the NASDAQ down 278 at 13,174. Europe mixed. France and Germany were higher. Asia mixed. 10-year yield 2.90% for the 10-year yield. And natural gas still has another down day, 6.923. So that dropped is kind of still staying down there a little bit off their recent high. But and I think it's about the rising rates, because Powell came out today and said, hey, taming this inflation is absolutely essential. And a 50 basis point hike is possible for May. So, Dave, I guess that's what Nate made the markets turn a little bit to the negative side today. So we'll see if he actually does. He will, as long as the markets stay where they're at. You know, even if the market dropped probably a couple thousand, he wouldn't shy away from that 0.50. But if they dropped 6,000? Yeah, he won't do it. They don't have the whatever they have. They don't have. They don't have it to do it. So anyway, I'm going to talk about Russia, what they have. And we're just going to update you on that. And it looks like Russia is ready to capture Mariupol. And that's the southern port city. And, of course, that's what you've seen most of the intense fighting on since they started all of this. Let's see, before lunch or after lunch, Azovstal will be completely under the control of the forces of the Russian Federation. And Azovstal, how do you say that, Dave?
Oh, I'd say Azovstal.
Azovstal. All right. Anyway, it's Mariupol's. That is the sprawling steel plant complex that is housing so many of the Ukrainian forces. And it's kind of like the city's last stand. And Ukrainian negotiators have said that Kyiv would be willing to negotiate releasing Russian prisoners for some safe passage of those civilians, Dave.
Well, interestingly, Putin has ordered his military to ditch plans to storm the steel plant. He's opting instead to completely seal off the facility via a blockade. He said he considers the proposed storming of that industrial zone unnecessary. And so he's ordering, or he ordered his troops to cancel it, citing preserving the lives of his soldiers as the main reason for his reasoning. He also urged the Ukrainians who were there in the steel plant to lay down their arms, claiming that Russia would treat them with respect, just like all those residents of Buka. Ukrainian troops have now ignored two Russian deadlines to surrender the southern port city, which has been the site of the most intense fighting since the war began. And unfortunately, thousands, there are tens of thousands, have been cut off from water and food and electricity and heating for just about the entire 2 months of Russia's invasion, Melody.
Well, you know, hey, we'll send them the money. We're going to give another $1.3 billion in assistance, another $800 million security package, and an additional $500 million in direct economic assistance for this war. This is the money the government can help us to stabilize their economy, to support communities that have been devastated by the Russian onslaught, and pay the brave workers that continue to provide essential services to the people. Yeah, that's a lot of money. It baffles me, but it's a lot of money. And I know, Dave, you're going to talk about, you know, some of the weaponry that they're sending over. I heard, I don't know if this is true, but I heard those 72 howitzers, those are Russian. No, maybe that's not what I'm thinking of.
Well, we know some of the weaponry that has been sent there were manufactured by Russia.
Yeah, we bought them for Afghanistan, and they were never given to Afghanistan. Helicopters. I don't know. Is that the howitzers?
No.
Those are missiles or whatever, right?
Yeah, well, they're missile launchers, yeah.
But we're sending over, I don't know, a bunch of these helicopters that were manufactured by Russia to give to Afghanistan when we never gave them to Afghanistan. And now they're going to Ukraine, and the problem is no one knows how to work the Russian equipment. So it's like money down the drain, folks. Go ahead, Dave.
Talk. Well, you know, this is the eighth installment of weaponry in the 2 months. 72 howitzers, 72 tactical vehicles to tow them, 144,000 artillery rounds, and 121 Phoenix Ghost tactical drones. John Kirby, who speaks for the Pentagon, said that the Phoenix Ghost drones were rapidly developed by the Air Force, specifically designed for Ukrainian military requirements. They're tactical unmanned aerial systems manufactured in California, and once the drones are in the region, U.S. troops are going to have to train Ukrainian forces on how to operate them. So there's another training issue. Presumably, these forces will be in Ukraine to do this training, so it'll be closer to harm's way. Biden said earlier that U.S. security assistance continues to flow into the region daily, and that European allies are stepping up the impact of the Western response. So all told, the U.S. has provided $4 billion, in fact, to Ukraine since the beginning of well, actually, the beginning of Biden's presidency last year.
My question is, the war only began 2 months ago, so why are we sending all that money to Ukraine to begin with?
Well, it's part of the foreign aid package that goes to many countries. Now, this was probably, you know, it started earlier because I'm guessing because of the buildup of Soviet troops in Belarus and in Western Russia before the invasion actually started. But who really knows? I mean, we know NATO also has well over 100 warships and 130 aircraft on heightened alert in the region as well. So as they say, some escalation looks to be in the offing, Melody.
Is it really worth it? That's the big question. Some think it is, and some do not. And, you know, I don't understand. There was a big G20 meeting in Washington, and a bunch of folks like our Treasury Secretary Yellen and Jerome Powell and other leaders of the central banks around the world. When the Russian finance minister turned to speak, they all walked out. My question is, why would they even invite him? Why didn't they disinvite him and allow him to even come?
Yeah, I'm surprised, it's stupid. And disappointed that it didn't happen. I'm not sure of what logistics might have prevented that from happening. I mean, technically, Russia's a part of the G20, but the sanctions,
to me, it's childish.
Level, you know,
it's childish.
Not to be disinvited from a meeting is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's childish. If they wanted to make a point, you know, why would they even have him on the schedule just to speak? You know, hey, if they couldn't turn him away because of the G20's, you know, rules and so forth and whatnot, but they didn't have to have him scheduled to speak. All right, well, if you want to show up, show up, but we ain't listening to you. I don't know.
I mean, again, I don't know. With at least 19 other nations there, most of them, all of them Western, just about, it's just hard to fathom that would have been permitted. Now, you know, unless, you know, the powers that be thought that, you know, both inviting them and having him speak presented this opportunity for this symbolic walkout, but, you know, really? Yeah. I mean, did it really up the embarrassment meter that much that, you know, they're humiliated as a result?
It's childish.
I don't know.
Childish. And then this, you know, you get these mixed messages because Wimbledon is going to ban Russian and Belarusian players. And, you know, Wimbledon hasn't barred individual athletes from specific countries since after World War II, when players from Germany, Japan, and some other nations were not permitted to play. And this happened quickly after, you know, Russia went into Ukraine. They did bar from team events like the Tennis Davis Cup and the Billie Jean King Cup, and both which were won by the Russian teams back in 2021. So, you know, the Boston Marathon had the same ban. How can you bar Russian and Belarus? I mean, anybody's welcome to the Boston Marathon, aren't they?
Not if you're from Russia and Belarus.
Well, and even the Paralympics. I mean, come on. You know?
It's guilt by association here. There's what's bothersome is that there's a presumption of guilt, that is guilt by association, that if you're from either of those countries that you support Putin and support the war. But those who say, well, just say you're against the war or don't support Putin in this, But that's we've seen what's happened to people like Navalny, who've been very outspoken against the Kremlin, and Putin's cronies followed Navalny all over the world, essentially, to poison him and try to kill him, and it just puts these athletes in an untenable situation. It's really talk about a lose-lose situation. I mean, you got, I think, the number two man in the world. I don't forget the women's rankings right now, but Medvedev from Russia, I think, is ranked number two in the men's tennis circuit. I mean, it's not good for the fans of the world who are paying ridiculous amounts for tickets. Anyway,
I think the one I can see, if it was maybe the Olympics, I get that. I can see that. But I think the one that probably is the Boston Marathon. That kind of, it's like, are you kidding me? Because that is supposed to, we're supposed to be a country, hey, open to everybody. So if you live here and you're Russian, you couldn't go to the Boston Marathon, correct?
I believe if you're a citizen of those countries, yeah, regardless of where you live.
What if you're not a citizen? What if you're just here on a green card or whatever?
Yeah, I don't know. You know? I don't know how far it extends.
But I mean, that's the one that kind of, it's like, are you kidding me? Well, you know, it's Thursday, Dave. What do we do on Thursday? Drum roll, please.
Jobless claims?
Yes. First time claims for benefits in the week ending April 16th totaled 184,000. That's only a decline of 2,000 from the previous week. A little bit higher than what they were expecting. The numbers kind of indicate that the country's employment picture remains historically tight with their numbers. The available labor pool is by about 5 million. Continuing claims, which run about a week behind the headline number, fell by 58,000. And a separate economic report today showed that manufacturing expanded in the Philadelphia area in April, but at a much slower pace than what was expected. Their reading registered a 17.6, now representing the difference between companies seeing expansion versus contraction. That was a decline of nearly 10 points from March, and also below the estimate of 21.9. Now, that's a major number drop. Measures of new order shipments, unfilled orders, delivery times, and the average employee work week showed declines from March. But prices paid and prices received both increased, Dave.
They did.
And I hear the music. We'll be right back, and we'll finish this up, jobless claims and other info, when we come back. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter, and you'll also get the blog at the end of the week. It's a great little, great information to receive from my co-host, Dave Allen. So sign up at dgscoins.com. And I think things are beginning to flow. We still have some delays in gold, in silver. We're hoping to get those. I want to thank everybody for their patience. When the Mint decides to mess with wholesalers' allotments and so forth, there's not much you can do, and the demand has been strong. So maybe heading into summer, I'm not sure if we're going to see a summer doldrums or not. You know, the old saying is, what is the old saying, Dave? Buy in May and go away?
That sounds good to me.
Yes, that's the old saying, buy in May and go away, and that leads us into the summer doldrums. So not sure if we're going to have that. It's an election year, so there is a possibility, but I don't see too much doldrums coming. I mean, I think prices will remain regardless. And, with the inflation and, hey, a 50 basis point hike possibly for May, that might put some action into these markets right now. So did you want to finish up anything on the jobless claims, Dave?
Well, the only thing I was going to say really was the today's numbers, some say, reflect the continued progress in hiring by companies across the country. I think the jury's still out in that. I mean, there's still 5 million more jobs than unfilled jobs, job vacancies, if you will. That's a lot. Total number of those receiving benefits is down to 1.6 million, but, it had been 17.4 a year ago. So that certainly far better, but the market still hasn't caught up to where it was before March of 2020. Now, again, the unemployment rate has fallen, the U6 rate, which includes discouraged workers, fell just south of 7% at the end of last month. And there's still 408,000 fewer Americans working than in February 2020. Labor market's also smaller by 174,000, according to the Labor Department. And the labor force participation rate is a full percentage point below its pre-pandemic level. So a lot of the mystery lies in that discouraged workers and those who are working part-time who can't find a full-time job despite all the jobs that are out there. Mm-hmm. Although admittedly, a lot of them are part-time, less than full-time jobs, I should say. So there you have it.
Yeah, you're going to have a lot of jobs available out there, but, you know, the quality and the pay, I think they're a little bit fewer. And you know, but long-term mortgage rates, we've talked about this, have risen for the seventh straight week. This is the highest level in more than a decade, 5.11%, just from 5% last week. The last time it was this high was in April of 2010, when it reached 5.21%. And I can remember back in 5.21%, that was still a cheap rate.
Yeah, yeah, we thought, wow, aren't we lucky?
Wow, aren't we? By contrast, a year ago, 30-year rate was only 2.97. So the average rates in recent months are the fastest pace of increases since 1994. And as I mentioned, they're going to take this aggressive approach to fighting inflation this year. We'll see how many increases they can have before it really starts hitting the financial markets. 50 basis points seems like it will be in May, Dave.
Well, it still seems like it's a seller's market out there, Melody. But maybe a lot of those buyers who stay tuned in to buying a new home may find that competition this spring has moderated somewhat. We still have inflation at a four-decade high, and mortgage rates, obviously, are on the rise. Still, you have elevated home prices and a tight supply of homes that are available for sale. So the goal of home ownership, particularly for those who rent, is still elusive, difficult, and expensive, especially for first-time buyers. So Freddie Mac says that the average rate on 15-year fixed-rate mortgages rose to about 4.38, up, it looks like, about 20, 21 basis points from a week earlier. A year ago, it stood at 2.29.
You know, I heard earlier today, I don't even remember what program it was, that I was watching some news program, and they were talking about these mortgage rates, Dave. And they were talking about, oh, but people have other options. They can go get the adjustable rate mortgages. Mm. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's always worked out well for people. But that's the route that now they're just going to load them up on that, and then people are going to be in worse shape here in a few years. And they're talking about, oh, the adjustable rate mortgages aren't like they were back in 2008 and before that. Oh, no, they're much better now. And they capped it. And it was like, no. They're the same. You know, because everybody expects your future to be better, but then bad things happen and it's not, and people can't, you know, the rates are adjusted. The next thing, your mortgage payment goes from something that was, you know, you were probably overboard to begin with, but you could handle it. Now all of a sudden your mortgage payment is $200 more, $300 more, $400 more a month.
Yeah.
And that just puts them under the water, and that's what we saw. We had all these adjustable rates just all at one time, and that was part of the problem. It wasn't all the problem, but it was part of it. And so now I couldn't believe I heard that, oh, well, they could get adjustable rate mortgages. They're better this time. Yeah. They don't make these better for the people.
Gimmicks often result in bubbles.
Absolutely.
And, bubbles often result. Bubbles inevitably burst. And when they do, it's not good for the economy or consumers that are a part of it.
No, and, you know, one of the, if you're looking at companies that expect to be profitable, you have the airlines, you know, and it just, airlines are my.
Your favorite industry?
Oh, my. No, the other end of the spectrum. You know, they get all the bailout money, they get all the government money, and you get the worst service. You get the, you know, they get you, they, most of them do get you to point A to point B. You're alive. But it's, and then they cheer when they give a rosy outlook for the rest of 2022.
I know.
You know?
That's a joke.
It just, the demand is as strong as we've ever seen it. The American CEO, Robert Islam told analysts shares of American and other airlines rose in morning trading today. American's upbeat view, this is the airline, American Airlines upbeat view, echoed similar comments from Delta and United, which both predicted in recent days that they will earn full year profits despite their big losses in the first quarter. I don't know what brought them to have big losses in the first quarter, but air travel, by the Omicron variant. I thought people were still flying. But anyway, people came back in March, and airline executives believe that Americans are eager to travel this summer. They don't have to wear masks anymore, for now anyway. And the recovery is powered by leisure travelers, but the airlines say they are seeing more business travelers also, Dave.
Yeah, but business travel still only 80% of pre-pandemic levels. Corporate travel is only 50% of 2019 levels. But Ism says that corporate bookings are now the highest they've been since the start of the pandemic. And of course, Mr. Cheery expects that to continue as more and more companies reopen their offices. But you got to have employees once you reopen your office there, Bobby. So in any event, and along with higher revenue, airlines face higher costs, particularly fuel and labor. Americans' fuel bill more than doubled from a year ago, and payroll costs have jumped by 15% plus. That's to attract people back. Airlines also facing a limited supply of pilots, as we talked about several weeks ago. This pilot shortage has resulted in significant reductions in scheduling at regional airports across the country. Some companies completely stopping routes, ending their routes there. I mean, Americans hired 1,100 pilots since the start of last year. And a lot of them came from these regional carriers. And so those carriers have no one to fly their planes. Then you have Alaska Air Group, says it lost $143 million in the first quarter. That's up $12 million. From a year earlier, but again, it's cheerful. Second quarter forecast says it'll be 5 to 8% higher. Then, of course, United Airlines reported a $1.4 billion loss for the first quarter, but it also expects to return to profitability in the second. So we will see, right, Melody?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm going to kind of let you do this about the 10-year yield. We give the rates on that every day. Most of our loans are attached to the 10-year rate. And, you know, it is very important.
It is. I mean,
but it isn't. But I don't think it's quite like it used to be. I don't, you know. But go ahead and tell the listeners, Dave.
Well, it's still important if only for its indirect effect on loans and other things. I mean, one of the most important numbers in the financial world is the 10-year Treasury note. But real 10-year Treasury yields, that is the bond yields after adjusting for inflation, they're poised right now to scramble back into positive territory for the first time in a couple of years. And analysts say that's a big deal. Said it's the moment when the Fed's effort to slow the economy by hiking rates actually begins to pinch in real life. Now, the conventional measure of real yields, that's the yield on a special kind of treasury note that's adjusted for inflation, has risen sharply. From below negative 1% in 2020 and most of last year to negative 0.07% yesterday. It's on the way up. Now, to compare, at the height of the 2008 financial crisis, the real yield was over 3%. And that's the highest it's been in the new millennium. Now, when real rates on treasuries are negative, savers like investors and some business people like to buy government bonds basically lose a good chunk of their money. And that makes saving unattractive compared to spending anyway. So people tend to spend and the economy tends to, well, strengthen. GDP growth increases. So when real rates go positive, it means savers can actually make more money via the interest on their savings accounts. They have a reason to save more and spend less, which can take some of the wind out of the economy's sail because growth is lower than it otherwise would have been. So now it's not like an on-off switch for the economy, but look, once rates go positive, it does mean we can expect the Fed's rate hikes to start influencing actual economic activity, at least somewhat more.
Yeah, but that doesn't that hold true? But then again, you know, they expect, I mean, I think they started out trying to move the economy one way or another by adjusting the rate and so forth. But in today's world, with the amount of debt that we have, I think it goes too negative in order to have the positive effect that it's supposed to. I mean, because you got all this corporate debt and they can't service at the higher rates. They've got, I mean, everything is based, and I don't think that it has the impact. Maybe mentally, and again, maybe it's, you know, the old words mean something more than the action.
Yeah.
I think it was Bernanke. But that's what they initially started out. But I just don't think it has the same power that it did. And I don't believe you can.
Debt has, and by debt I mean government debt, local government debt, state government debt, federal, national debt. Consumer debt, and yes, as you mentioned, corporate debt. It's not just here, but all around the world.
Right.
It's exploded over the last 20 years. And it's a different equation. And I think it's why the Fed, I don't know if the Fed heads are spinning as much as ours are, those of us who are supposed to benefit from their actions one way or the other. And I think it's another reason, probably the primary reason why the effectiveness of their action is a lot more questionable as time has gone on. And I mean, do you wonder why? Do you question that? 28 yes. trillion in national debt?
It's 30.
Yeah. Sorry, I fell asleep yesterday.
As far, yeah. We blinked. And it went to Ukraine. No. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio, Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
One more time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen here for the last segment of the program. Melody taking care of other client business. You can reach her at 1-800-375-4188. Just quickly here, Fed Bank of Chicago announced today that its president, Charles Evans, Charlie, I think he's known as, will retire from his position early next year. Evans, who's 64 years old, joined the Chicago Fed in 1991 and has served in his current role since 2007. He's known for helping have developed the so-called dot plot Federal Open Market Committee now publishes that shows participants' view of different aspects of monetary policy, their projections, what have you. As the longest-serving member on the Fed. And recently, Evans said he believes current Fed policy on interest rates is wrong-footed and will need to be adapted. So we will look to see who the president is going to nominate. I think the Fed nominates the Fed presidents, the regional ones. But in any event, whenever we see a name, we'll be sure to bring that to you. Rising rates, interest rates in the U.S. have propelled the dollar to its strongest in almost 2 years, at least relative to its foreign counterparts. We talked a little bit about this on Tuesday. As we know, a resurgent dollar makes imported goods cheaper, thus indirectly containing inflation. But it could become a headache for multinational corporations as the rise trims company earnings when they convert their revenues earned abroad into dollars. Now, the recent sell-off in U.S. government bonds has driven up rates, making U.S. assets more attractive and boosting more global demand for the U.S. dollar, still the world's top reserve currency, certainly a traditional reputation of being a safe haven for investors. The difference between U.S. government bond yields and those of Europe and Japan have sent the latter two currencies reeling. Dollars added 10% against the Japanese yen and 5% against the euro so far this year. Mark Chandler at Bonnickburn Global Forex notes that amid a historic sell-off in bonds, foreign investors have bought a record amount of U.S. securities over the 6 months through February, at an average of $126 billion a month. Chandler added, someone's been selling U.S. bonds, but it doesn't look like it's been Japan or central banks. Foreign investors have been significant buyers of U.S. assets through February. Consumers are pretty indifferent to currency fluctuations because we don't pay attention to it, and the effects are often behind the scenes. Sometimes they spring into view in ways that hurt big U.S. companies. Most notably, the yen's languishing over a 20 or near a 20-year low against the dollar, which tends to make the U.S. manufacturing sector nervous. Historically, U.S. car makers have been sensitive to the dollar-yen exchange rate, too, because of fears that, well, the U.S. market will get flooded with cheap imports. Now, so far, this latest earnings seasons, companies have been relatively mum on the dollar. But it's still early in the year, really just third week into the second quarter. And amid the dollar index's march higher, perceived wisdom is that at some point that strength becomes a headwind to U.S. equity performance. We're already seeing that. But remember, as I pointed out in Monday's blog, which we talked about on Tuesday, although the U.S. dollar index has been inching higher and higher, the dollar's actually been weakening at the fastest pace since the 1980s. The dollar index compares the U.S. dollar to one or more of its foreign peers, again, like the yen or the euro. And the dollar is looking strong versus its counterparts. But again, the measure of strength that matters for consumers especially isn't how many yen or euros they can buy, but how many goods and services their cash can purchase. Inflation drives the purchasing power of the dollar and the yen and the euro and the peso and on and on and on. And it drives them down. The bottom line, Americans' purchasing power has fallen 98% since the Fed was created to preserve it over 100 years ago. Remember that. It's critical. Let's go back to the World Bank and IMF meeting. Every April, the world's finance ministers and other economic policy leaders descend on Washington for this spring meeting. Things feel different this year, though, they say, and not just because D.C. has had a chilly spring. The world's facing big economic challenges, global supply shortages that defy the ability of these policymakers to solve through their clever management of spending or interest rates. Through the last 15 years of financial crises and slow recovery, the world faced serious economic problems, but ones that were largely linked to the internal workings of their economies. Well, Dr. Data, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, delivered a sternly worded speech recently, assailing Russia for its aggression and, in effect, threatening countries that assist it with access to the global economy. And yesterday, the IMF released its World Economic Outlook, projecting lower global growth and higher inflation. Fund reduced its 2022 global growth projection by almost 1 percentage point. Almost 3 percentage points for emerging markets. That forecast is premised on the war remaining confined to Ukraine. Further sanctions exempting the Russian energy sector and the pandemic continuing to fade, none of which is a sure thing whatsoever. And also the other day, Yellen addressed the rising risk of famine due to a collapse of food, fuel, and fertilizer exports from, yes, Russia and Ukraine. So now the course of the economy depends on the course of the war. And talk about volatility and uncertainty, ladies and gentlemen. Whew, that's our new future. Invest accordingly. Now, it's interesting. Europe is struggling to find ways to stop Russia stop paying Russia $850 million every single day and hit the Kremlin's finance over Putin's war. But the EU is finding that reversing decades of, well, this reliance is not a simple matter. Leaders are now discussing sanctions on Russian oil, including even a possible boycott. Well, here's what little what that could mean for people in Europe and the rest of the world. Gas and oil are flowing to Europe even as governments denounce the war. The EU sends 450 mil a day to Russia for oil and another 400 mil a day for natural gas. That means energy revenue boosts the Kremlin's budget, adding to foreign currency reserves, even as these, wow, mega Western sanctions have targeted Russia's reserves abroad. In fact, the Russian government got an average of 43% of its revenue from oil and gas between 2011 and 2020. Europe's the biggest purchaser of Russian crude, receiving 138 million tons in 2020 out of Russia's total exports of 260 million tons. That's over 50%. Europe, which imports almost all of its crude, gets a quarter of its needs from Russia. Natural gas is off the table for now. Heavy users of it, like Germany, say an immediate cutoff would cost jobs, with widespread warnings of shutdowns in glass and metal businesses. And cutting off both natural gas and oil would likely cause a recession, a deep recession in Europe and elsewhere. Europe imported almost 4 million barrels a day from Russia before the war. In theory, European customers could replace those barrels from suppliers in, say, the Middle East, but it would take time for global markets to make that adjustment. Refineries making gas and other products are set up for Russia's particular kind of oil, and several major refineries depend on a pipeline from Russia. But many analysts think that European countries should be ready to impose measures to reduce their fuel use, such as making public transport free and incentivize car sharing. And they say if those measures don't work, tougher ones like odd-even driving bans based on license plate numbers just might be needed. Similar measures were taken during the 1973 OPEC oil embargo, when Germany, you might remember, imposed car-free Sundays. Well, prices for oil would go up all across the world, because oil's a global commodity, and a net loss of supplies for Russia would almost be certain. That would mean higher costs for driving and home heating oil, more for consumer inflation, until prices would eventually moderate, which could be years. In the meantime, the increased financial and political volatility in Russia could make Putin even more predictable. And finally today, an article in the May issue of The Atlantic is a fitting look at how America has fractured and what's going to happen if we don't find a way to fix it. Jonathan Haidt, who's a social psychologist at NYU Stern School of Business, writes, "In the 20th century, America built the most capable knowledge-producing institutions in American history. In the past decade, though, they got stupider en masse. All day we're barraged with tiles in the mosaic. This data point, that data point, this hot take, that hot take." Haidt's view of America in 2022 is an excuse to step back and behold what future historians will say. Similar to Melody's comment, the last segment about, well, what our kids and grandkids, the Gen Zs of the world, are going to be saying 30, 40 years from now when they hit 60. After Babel, Haidt invokes the Genesis tale of the Tower of Babel, where God is angered by early humans' hubris, then scrambles their languages. Well, Haidt sees a metaphor for what is happening now, not only between red and blue, but within the left and within the right, as well as within universities, companies, professional associations, museums, and even families. In the past 10 years, especially mid-decade, 2011 to 2015, he writes, something went terribly wrong very suddenly. We're disoriented, unable to speak the same language, or even recognize the same truths. Some of what he says happened. The early internet looked like a boon to democracy. MySpace, Friendster, Facebook made it easy to connect with friends and strangers to talk about common interests for free and at a scale never before imaginable. Instead, the like button, retweet, and comments encouraged dishonesty and mob dynamics. Of three major forces that collectively bind together successful democracies, social media has weakened all three. Social capital, extensive social networks with high levels of trust, strong institutions, and even our shared stories. Haidt writes that this process plays out differently on the right and the left because each of their activist wings subscribe to different narratives with different sacred values. The right share a narrative in which America is eternally under threat from enemies outside and subversives within. They see life as a battle between patriots and traitors. With the left, life at every institution is an eternal battle among identity groups over a zero-sum pie. This new narrative is rigidly egalitarian, focused on equality of outcomes, not of rights or opportunities. So, what's next? Haidt warns it's going to get much worse. He says, if we do not make major changes soon, then our institutions, our political system, and our society may indeed collapse. Well, Haidt's prescriptions for redesigning democracy for the digital age do look elusive, hardening democratic institutions and reforming social media. Good luck with that. Haidt puts our hope in Gen Z, those born in 1997 and before, who bear none of the blame for the mess we're in. That generation's admirable embrace of mission and activism indeed could be our salvation. Or at least theirs and their children's. That's all the time we have for today's program. Thanks for sticking with us. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody back tomorrow with Butch. Also be on the lookout for our blog in your email inboxes in the morning. Thanks as always to our engineer Todd, and to you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Have a great evening. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.